From the KGOU studios, I'm Suzette Gorlott, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma, and welcome to Worldviews. Today I'll talk with Kevin Bales. He's a native of Ponca City who's devoted his career to studying human trafficking. 150 years ago, a slave was a major investment, but he says over the past several decades, the price of human beings has collapsed.
And they stopped being capital purchase items like a tractor or a giant truck and became more like styrofoam cups that you could buy very cheaply, use up, and throw away. They became disposable.
He says about 700 million people in the world could be enslaved because they're not protected by the rule of law or don't have enough money to buy their way out of a problem.
If we only have about 30 million people in the world in slavery, it's actually a good thing that it's only 30 million.
We'll talk about the economics and social anthropology of modern-day human trafficking right after this hour's news from NPR. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gorlott. My guest today is author and activist Kevin Bales. The Oklahoma native earned his Ph.D. from the London School of Economics in the 1990s and has devoted his career to the economics and social anthropology of modern-day slavery. He's best known for his book, Disposable People, which he most recently updated in 2012. Bales also co-founded the international human rights organization Free the Slaves. In 2006, the Association of British Universities named his work one of the top 100 world-changing discoveries of the last 50 years. Kevin Bales, welcome to Worldviews.
Great to be here.
Kevin, welcome back to Oklahoma. This is your home, right? You're from Ponca City. You went to school here at the University of Oklahoma and graduated with a degree in social anthropology. But you've been working over the past several years on the issue of human trafficking, modern-day slavery. But you wrote a very important book in 1999 called Disposable People, The New Slavery and the Global Economy. Can you tell us about that argument that you're talking about, disposable people? This is not, you know, a kind term. What is it about these people that are disposable?
Well, and I appreciate it. It's not a very kind term, but the title, of course, was to help people, in a sense, shock people a little bit, to help them look into the book. One of the things that I discovered when I was doing the research for that book was that the price of slaves had collapsed globally. That if you looked across all of human history, slaves had in fact been very expensive capital purchase items for economic processes. And so, you know, if you go back to the Deep South before the Civil War, the average price of an average slave, meaning like a 19-year-old agricultural worker, was around $1,000 to $1,200, $1,850. But in 1850, you could buy a nice house for $1,000. You could buy 300 or 400 acres of land for $1,000. It was the equivalent of a major purchase to buy a slave. That's actually the truth across most of human history. And yet, sometime after the 1960s, 70s, something to do probably with both political change, economic change, and the population explosion that occurred over the same period, the price of human beings has collapsed. And they stopped being capital purchase items like a tractor or a giant truck and became more like styrofoam cups that you could buy very cheaply, use up, and throw away. They became disposable.
But, so what explains that? What is it that has happened that has made people disposable? I mean, obviously, population has grown. Slavery is supposedly outlawed, right? People have been emancipated. So why is it that now it is so cheap to buy labor and people are so disposable?
Well, slavery certainly continued after the end of legal slavery. Sadly, a lot of people, including politicians, seem to believe that they made it illegal and so it disappeared, which is a little bit like saying, you know, after the Ten Commandments, no one ever committed adultery again. It didn't work out that way with slavery either. But primarily, I believe that it was about the glut of potentially enslavable people. It was a flooded market. So both the very dramatic increases in population, particularly in the developing world, and the economic changes in the developing world that came with decolonization and so forth, also in a context where conflict can create situations of vulnerability, it just meant that there were a lot more people who were available to enslave. It's rather hard to calculate precisely, but my best estimate is that there's something like 700 million people in the world who are potentially enslavable. In other words, they don't have the protections of the rule of law. They don't have enough money in their pocket to buy their way out of a problem. You know, they're in a situation, they may be refugees, for example, where they are potentially enslavable. And that's an interesting paradox because if we only have about 30 million people in the world in slavery, it's actually – it sounds odd – a good thing that it's only 30 million if we have 700 million who are potentially enslavable.
Well, so this relates to another book that you've written about ending slavery. I mean, you just identified a number of causes of potentially enslaving people, conflict, a lack of development, these sorts of things. So one would presume that then to end slavery, you have to address these issues. You have to address conflict where it happens. You have to address poverty where it happens so that's what's going to prevent slavery from having, ending it where it is and preventing it from happening further into the future?
The answer to that question is yes or no, because you can't end all the poverty in the world before you begin to end slavery. But you can certainly go to places where people are in slavery, address their enslavement first, almost as a law enforcement issue, so that you do what's necessary to help them come to freedom and to establish themselves economically and as citizens. And one of the interesting things is that then begins to address the poverty problem that they're suffering as well. Because once freed, they have a chance to work for themselves. They begin to be much more productive. And they also get very excited actually about earning and providing for their own children.
So this concept then of freedom, obviously – slavery is the opposite of freedom, right? I mean, if you are freed, if you're emancipated, then you are no longer a slave and as you said, has all of these positive outcomes. But you've also discussed this concept in your work of botched emancipation and how a lack of support after emancipation. I mean, you started this conversation by saying, just because we emancipated you or just because we've ended slavery doesn't mean it really ended. Is that what you're referring to when you talk about botched emancipation or what does that mean?
Well, normally when I talk about the botched emancipation, I use as the example what we did here in the United States because if you look across all the anti-slavery movements and all the situations of slavery in history, we kind of blew it as Americans in the most serious way. Compared to other places, most countries brought an end to legal slavery without having a civil war that killed 700,000 people. And most countries did so without necessarily lifting, as we did in this country, 2 million people up out of slavery and then dumping them without access to credit, to meaningful political participation, without access to decent education, and then putting them within a context of discrimination and prejudice and violence. We're still paying the price for the botched emancipation of 1865. Now, you can see that today as well. There are groups that are focused on rescuing people and they'll dash in and find people in slavery and they'll pull them out and they say, you're free now. Good luck to you. But the truth is that if you've been in slavery for a while and you have nothing, you're destitute, you may have post-traumatic stress disorder, you may have terrible injuries. I mean, there's so many things that could come out of slavery in that way. That if you don't give people a chance, it doesn't have to be 40 acres and a mule, but if you don't give them some kind of a chance and some kind of a help and some kind of therapy perhaps or education or even just a little loan to get something started, they can easily fall back into a situation where it may not be slavery, but they're certainly going to be vulnerable to other kinds of exploitation.
So obviously the subject is extremely complicated in the sense that, you know, trying to prevent these conditions from arising to begin with, trying to address those challenges where you do find them, those millions of people, tens of millions of people that are, you know, experiencing enslavement today, but then trying to provide them the services, the support, the institutions, the opportunities beyond emancipation. So, you know, like any other extremely complicated issue, where do you attack this problem? I assume the answer is from all fronts all at once, but that just, you know, what, do we become paralyzed? Because, you know, I think to many of us who study these issues and know something about human trafficking, you sometimes feel extremely helpless and hopeless. And, you know, there's a significant amount of despair about how do you address this issue, particularly one that is invisible in some ways, is so far away in other ways. I mean, how do you bridge that gap?
Listen, we should not feel despair and we should not feel overwhelmed. If we do, we're actually looking too closely at the problem part of this and not at the opportunity. The truth of the matter is that 29 million people in the world in slavery is the smallest fraction of the global population to ever be in slavery. It's a minute fraction of the global population. The somewhere around $150 billion a year that's part of the slave part of economic output in the global economy is the smallest fraction of the global economy ever represented by slave labor. There's the number of people in slavery is smaller than the number of people with HIV. We're actually living in a world where the eradication of slavery is possible. And I think it's actually probable because it's illegal in every country. Most cultures have now rejected it on moral grounds as well as political grounds. And while it's complex and while it's criminal, we're actually in a place where change can occur. And not least because to address a, sort of another part of your question, you know, where do you start? Well, you do have to start in many places at once. You have to get government policies right. You have to get businesses lined up to stop and to help them make sure they don't have slavery in their supply chain. But if you really want to end slavery, the way you do it is you go where slavery is. And you do, for example, the community organizing you have to do in communities where slavery exists so that the community says, we reject slavery. This will be a slave-free place and a slave-proof place from this day forward. And that's really when you end slavery. And if you do that enough, it spreads and slavery comes to an end.
So part of this solution then involves educating those of us who consume goods that might be produced by slave labor, but also working with businesses. You just mentioned, for example, businesses to make sure that they're aware or are able to, willing to remove from their supply chain those suppliers that are using improper labor practices and modern day slaves. So you recently wrote an article, for example, about how slavery is bad for business. So can you tell us a little bit about how you can analyze this issue and help us understand its negative impact on the economy? Because I think many of us think, well, that's why it happens, is because it's good for business, right? It happens because people are making money. It's profit driven. People wouldn't do it if they weren't making money. So how is it that it's bad for business?
Well, it's good for criminal businesses. And if we're okay with all businesses making good profits, no matter whether they're run by legitimate or criminals, then that's the kind of capitalism I personally don't adhere to. But the truth is that very often, leaving slavery aside, when criminal businesses are extremely profitable, it begins to eat into legitimate business. I mean, we know that occurs all over the world. The situation fundamentally, though, is that slavery is like a drag on an economy. You take whatever the portion of your population is in slavery and you basically remove them as economic agents from your economy. Slaves consume virtually nothing. Then their production side is actually very low. Most slaves in the world operate in derivative, simple, dirty, dangerous jobs that produce at a very low level. They're cost effective because they're free. But, you know, in terms of output, they're pathetic, and which is a strange word to say about a slave, and I apologize that, about that in a way, but it's true. And then they don't consume. So they're almost a zero in the economic equation anywhere they are. What we've been doing over a number of years is carrying out longitudinal research in areas like northern India where we trace villages where almost everyone in the village is in hereditary slavery. And we survey very carefully their activities in slavery through the process of liberation and out the back end in freedom. We're now up to about 7 years watching that process occur. And, you know, everything points in the same direction. There's a very significant freedom dividend that when you bring people out of slavery in a community, particularly when that's a high proportion of the population, the local economy begins to spiral up very quickly. Because people buy things and they also take their children out of the workplace immediately. I have to say every slave family that I've ever met who's come to freedom, the first thing they want to do is build a school for their kids and get their kids to safety and education. And then they want more food and they want medicine and they want tools and they want to do other things besides swing a hammer and break up rocks. And it all begins to work. And ironically, sometimes even slave masters do better economically when they are stopped from being slave masters because there are often rich people in the area who own the shops where freed slaves go to buy things and they begin to realize they're doing better on retail than they were from slave labor.
That's absolutely fascinating description. But I have to ask before we go about your most recent project, the thing you're working on now that we'll be seeing soon is this relationship between slavery and the environment. Can you just tell us very quickly what that has to do? Because this economic argument is fundamental, and we all think about that. But we don't think about the connection between slavery and environmental degradation.
Well,
tell us about that.
In a nutshell, it's just after I was studying slavery around the world, I began to notice that everywhere I studied slavery, the environment was just a catastrophe. It was wrecked. And I set out then to measure how much environmental destruction is actually carried out with slave labor. When I spent about 5 years doing that all around the world, I discovered it was much more than anyone had ever guessed, to the point, particularly with things like deforestation, the shocking calculation is that if slavery were a country, even though it's only 30 million people, it would be the third largest emitter of greenhouse gases after China and the United States. In other words, if we actually wanted to bring greenhouse gas emissions down to the point to stabilize climate change, one way to do that would simply to be enforce the laws against slavery.
Absolutely fascinating. We'll be looking forward to that. Thank you so much, Kevin, for being with us today to talk about this extremely important topic. Thank you.
It's been my pleasure. It's great to be back.
You've been listening to my conversation with Kevin Bales, the author of several books about modern-day slavery and human trafficking, who co-founded the organization Free the Slaves. We have an excerpt of his book, Disposable People, on our website, kgou.org. Worldviews is a collaborative partnership between the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies and KGOU that's supported by you, our listeners and members. For Symphony Swift, who prepares our interview research and books our guests, Sarah Hurd and Holly Arias, who handle our digital content, and our producer, Brian Hardzinski, I'm Suzette Gorlott.